Thank you, Len. We're going to need to move on because we're running over time. The last presentation by Dr. Seidel will be on the topic risks of using enriched uranium to produce medical isotopes. Dr. Seidel.
This is a paper written by Dr. Robert Gould and myself, and with Bob's permission, I'm going to shorten it materially so we'll have more time for discussion. The points that I'll make very quickly are the following. There are radioisotopes that are used in diagnostic imaging procedures, and the one that is used, technetium-99, is used in a major portion of imaging procedures. The production of these isotopes, radioisotopes, involves the use of highly enriched uranium, and only a small portion of that highly enriched uranium is consumed, which means that the rest is stockpiled in a number of countries. It's possible to produce these radioisotopes without the use of highly enriched uranium, and instead to produce it by low enriched uranium. The danger, of course, of use of highly enriched uranium is that when it's stockpiled, it is subject to transfer or loss or theft, and only about 50 kilograms of this highly enriched uranium can be used to make a simple nuclear bomb. This is the nuclear bomb that was used on Hiroshima, one of the two that were used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The other one was a different type, but this is the one that used the highly enriched uranium. And this is a simple model of what someone could do, a group could do, using the highly enriched uranium to produce a bomb. Use of low-enriched uranium to produce the tracers is feasible. It's actually cheaper than the use of the highly enriched uranium, but the manufacturers of the radioisotopes refuse to change because it will cost them money to make the change. And what we are arguing is that there should be a switch to the low-enriched uranium. And even though these pharmaceuticals are extremely important in medical care, it would be possible to produce them using the low enriched uranium, and to continue the use of highly enriched uranium is a public health threat. And this final slide talks about the responsibilities of health workers to deal with this. Now, let me just make one final comment at the end. This policy statements, resolutions, with regard to calling on manufacturers to use low-enriched uranium rather than highly-enriched uranium have been produced by a number of medical societies and public health societies. The most recent one, which Bob Gould worked through, was by the California Medical Association, which adopted a resolution calling for the shift from highly-enriched uranium to low-enriched uranium. Now, the point that I'd like you to remember, if you would, is what the policy of APHA is with regard to this. Bob Gould and I produced 2 years ago a late-breaking resolution on what was going on in Iraq that was delayed by the process of APHA. We finally managed to fight it through and get it adopted virtually unanimously by the leading by the body that deals with that, by APHA. Last year, we worked through a policy statement calling for the United States not to attack Iran, and that also was blocked by the Joint Policy Committee, and we fought that through and eventually got it adopted by the Governing Council. This year, we put through a late-breaking resolution with regard to highly enriched uranium, quoting the California Medical Association and other groups. And again, the Joint Policy Committee said no, this was not a timely resolution, and they refused to consider it. It was not discussed in the reference committees. If any of you see a badge that has this ribbon, I don't know what color do I call that? I guess it's purple. Purple ribbon that says Governing Council. If you see them between now and tomorrow morning when the Governing Council meets, ask them if they didn't think that a resolution calling for an end to the use of highly enriched uranium as a public health threat should be permitted to be discussed by the Governing Council. And if you get through to them, we'll be trying to move a special motion at the end of the day tomorrow calling for a permission to bring this forward to the Governing Council. But APHA, which has been very active in many good measures over the years, APHA led a march in Las Vegas to the nuclear test site, protesting nuclear testing. And over the years, there's been much done. But for some reason, over the past couple of years, the Governing Council and the staff have been very resistant to these kinds of statements. So if you have any influence, if you have any way of talking with Governing Councilors, please do so. Thank you very much.
We have a little bit of time, and I just want to take the prerogative first to give you an opportunity to ask any questions for Dr. Seidel. Is there a question here? Question? No? Any other questions? Yes, please.
The issue for the manufacturers is the cost of shifting to another. I mean, it's the Bob, you want to comment on what the resistance is? I mean, my understanding is that it's going to cause trouble in the production process. It's both the cost of shifting and changing their production methods. Actually, overall, the cost is going to be lower of using low enriched uranium. But right now, the resistance to doing it.
Vic has encapsulated the issues. There's resistance to upfront costs, which are not that much, but it's just that they would have to foot that. There's been a number of years ago, there was a revision of federal legislation that was would have facilitated the shift to low-enriched uranium, but the pharmaceutical producers, most of whom are outside of the United States, like Mallinckrodt in Canada, prevailed upon the American College of Radiologists to resist these types of changes. And I encountered at the California Medical Association some radiologists would say, well, if we do this, we're going to have patient shortages. That's not the case. In fact, information that comes out of expert at the Monterey Institute of Nonproliferation Studies indicates that the University of Missouri, for example, has a model program that would supply half of, by the year 2012, would supply half of the technetium-99 that would be used for scans through the low-enriched uranium technology, which is already, at this point, used by 5% of the producers around the world, places like Egypt and Argentina.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yes, please.
My question is to Director Rubenstein regarding apparently the apple grape thing was not isolated. It was quite a few people saw. I mean, it was rather widespread, the torture. And there's a reason to believe that psychologists, some of whom probably were not military trained, were part of that, or at least providing their blessing. My question is, do you think that it sounds like Dr. Trinosky is proposing or suggesting that if there's some change in the training or the more use of non-military trained personnel in the military can make that better? Is there any reason to believe that that's something that that you think would work? Or does it make any difference? There's probably been studies done on it.
The question was, as I understand it, you correct me, was whether the lack of bringing in psychologists and physicians who are not trained in the military might make a difference. Is that right in terms of wrongdoing?
Is that,
well, I can say a few things. We don't have any empirical evidence on this at the moment. But what we do know is that in order to facilitate torture, the Defense Department actually changed the ethical standards of military physicians and psychologists so they could participate in interrogation, planning, and execution as part of so-called behavioral science consultation teams, which still exist. Now, the medical community has passed ethical standards saying you can't participate in interrogations. The American Psychological Association has to date refused to do that. But the point is that the Defense Department adopted ethical standards that now deviate from the medical community. And in the past, the goal was to have the same ethical standards for military medical personnel as for civilian medical personnel, and there was a lot of pride in that. And so we're seeing this difference between civilian and military being played out even in the ethical standards that they're operating under. And I think that's a very bad thing.
We can take one last question, then we'll conclude. To any of our speakers. Okay.
It's greatly impressive to talk. Okay.
Just stand up if you would, just so
I... Yeah. I'm a physician from Los Angeles. With all the attention on Guantanamo and the role of Americans in torturing captives, as well documented as you have, there's been reports of other so-called black sites, particularly Diego Garcia, where these things are going on. They are not Do you have any
further
information about that?
The question was what I talked about military facilities, but there's also information in the press about black sites operated by the CIA that are still in existence or may well be still in existence. And what do I have to say about that? Well, the first thing to say is you're right that we can't get information about them. And they are highly secret. There have been leaks to the press. What is important to understand is while the Defense Department in 2006 repudiated almost all the methods that I talked about, there are still problems with authorization of isolation and sleep deprivation, but the Defense Department agreed to abide by the Geneva Conventions and not use methods considered torture by the rest of the world. The Bush administration has fought very hard, and in fact, the president vetoed legislation, and Senator McCain voted to support the veto, that would have applied those Army standards to the CIA. To this day, legal opinions are in place which authorize the CIA to engage in methods that we would consider illegal, although we don't know what those methods are. We still believe the black sites like Diego Garcia exist, but we don't have information about what's going on there. Until those policies are repudiated, that is, the legal opinions, the authorization to deviate from military standards are repealed, it's likely that this will continue. So it's up to the next president to say no more. But as we speak today, we have no reason to believe the CIA has stopped torturing people.
On that note, we'll conclude the session. I'd like to, Dr. Seidel and I would like to thank Bob Gould and Patrice Sutton for their leadership of the Peace Caucus. Encourage you to join if you haven't already. And again, thank you for your active listening and participation.